Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Very glad you have joined us. On today's show, Michigan's U.S. Senate seat is open come 2014, just sitting there waiting for the taking. So just who would take over the job opening after Carl Levin's retirement? We'll speak with Congressman Gary Peters, Democrat, who's announced that he wants the job. And then we speak with a Republican strategist about why no Republicans have yet to jump in the race. What does it mean for the GOP's chances if a candidate takes too long to announce? Then, later in the hour, a conversation with the music director of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, Maestro Leonard Slatkin, as he prepares the DSO to play Carnegie Hall for the first time in 17 years. But first, to Lansing, where we've been following a bill that's working its way through the state legislature. This legislation would require people getting welfare benefits to pass a drug test in order to receive those benefits. The substance abuse screening would be required if there is, quote, reasonable suspicion that the person is using illegal drugs. Republican Representative Jeff Farrington sponsored the bill in the House. He says the government should not pay for people's drug habits.
People are tired of applicants getting welfare payments when they're using it for illegal drug use. We want to make sure that they get on the right track, they receive their treatment going forward, and they get on the right path to success.
So supporters of the bill say only people who test positive would have to pay for the cost of the drug test. Critics say suspicion-based drug testing demonizes the poor and hurts children of addicts. Melissa Smith is a senior policy analyst with the Michigan League for Public Policy. She researched the effectiveness of these welfare drug testing programs, and she joins us now from Lansing. Welcome to Stateside, Melissa.
Thank you so much for having me.
So as this bill's been picking up momentum in the state legislature, Melissa, you've analyzed how suspicion-based drug testing is working in the states that have already implemented such programs. So what did your research find?
Well, most interesting is that no one is doing suspicionless drug testing anymore because the courts have kind of thrown the hammer down with Florida, who is the first state to try to implement such a policy since Michigan's attempt in 1999. And there's always been some real question around the suspicionless portion of the drug testing on whether or not it met constitutional muster. And the courts have, while not firmly coming down and saying it absolutely is unconstitutional, and the decision made in the Florida case has basically made most states that were considering such an option scramble to change their drug policy or to change what they wanted to implement to be more in line with what the Constitution would require. So what we're only talking about now when we talk about drug testing for public assistance programs is suspicion-based drug testing. And you'll see that Michigan, when it initially started this legislation, it was a suspicionless bill, and it has gone through a lot of changes and a very, very dramatic change just recently before it passed out of the House. And we saw a lot of things get addressed in this last version of the bill.
What got changed? What were some of the dramatic changes?
Yeah, so one of them was that up until last week when this bill was put in front of the House committee to be passed out, it initially required that both those who test positive and negative would pay for that drug test. And so that has been changed, and now only those that test positive for drugs mm-hmm. will be required to pay for that. But the most important change that we see in this bill and that although I am not a fan of drug testing for government benefits, it is certainly a much, much kinder bill in that it doesn't immediately cut someone off who tests positive for substance abuse.
So what does it do? Give them a chance to seek treatment?
Yes. And it's still really unclear from the bill exactly what is included in that, but it does require that the Department of Human Services refer someone to the Regional Substance Abuse Coordinating Agencies for the state. And I believe there are 16 in the state that coordinate different types of substance abuse treatment. Now, we do know that in the past, some of these substance abuse treatment agencies have had waiting lists. May not be able to handle an increased capacity or even the capacity of what they have, and they have suffered from some budget cuts.
You wrote a pretty detailed paper looking into these kinds of bills about a year ago. It was called Drug Testing,
yes.
A Solution Looking for a Problem. And one of the points you make is how the state of Michigan has continually defunded substance abuse treatment. So it does seem that that's still a problem.
It is still a problem. There are waiting lists in many areas. There are issues of transportation, especially in the more rural areas. It would be horrible if someone were to be referred to get drug treatment, but then they would lose their benefits simply because they lived in a location where services were not available for them. And then the thing that's so important to remember is that two-thirds of the people that receive government assistance, that receive the program dollars, are children. So whenever we make a decision about a recipient, whenever we say your benefits could be cut, we're not just talking about a parent. We're talking about their children. And there, despite attempts to have an amendment passed that allowed a third-party beneficiary to continue to receive benefits should someone fail a drug test, that did not pass. So there is no option if for some reason someone lives in an area where they are referred for drug treatment and they can't get into drug treatment, the entire family then loses that benefit amount.
What can you tell us based on the research you've done, based on Michigan's drug testing policy in 99 and also in other states? You looked at Florida, you looked at Indiana, you looked at Arizona. What were the results for all of the effort of doing the testing? What kind of results did they get?
Well, you know, in Florida, for the few months that it did its broad-based drug testing, which meant everyone who applied to get cash assistance in Florida was drug tested, 2% actually tested positive out of 7,000 people that were tested. In Indiana, which did drug testing for work readiness programs, had a 1% tested positive. My favorite is in 2009, Arizona, whose actually was suspicion-based, so it did have a screening. They had 64,000 people screened, 16 people required to take the test, 8 refused, and 1 failed. So 1 person failed out of 64,000 people.
So what does that tell us?
It tells us that we're throwing a lot of money and energy towards a problem that doesn't exist in the scope that people think it does. It tells us that we're making policy based on stereotypes about poor people and the type of people that are needing to turn to the government in one of the worst economic recessions of our history.
What do you think, based on your research, Melissa, that what other options or ideas are there that would achieve the same outcome? Because when you hear people who say, well, I don't want one of my tax dollars going to support someone who's on drugs, that does seem like a pretty fair thing to not want. But what could be done, in your view, to accomplish that in a way that doesn't demonize the poor or punish children?
Absolutely. And I do want to say that I don't necessarily support that people should be using a bunch of drugs and being allowed to take government dollars.
Sure.
I'm definitely not for that. However, I do understand what it means to live in poverty, and what I have a lot of experience with working with people who deal with addiction, and I know that it takes a lot more than just the threat of a drug test or something like that to help people really achieve success. And when we're talking about people that are on cash assistance, it's usually because they don't have any other safety net. They don't have a lot of the bolstering around them to help them get through difficult things, such as dealing with an addiction. So we need to think about, if we really want to help people to rise above substance abuse, we need to provide support. We need to make sure, which is why one thing on this latest bill that came through, I'm very, very pleased to see that we're not cutting people off immediately. I just want to make sure the plan's going to work, that we're going to have a good amount of support, that people are not going to get punished simply because they can't access something in their area, and that we have a better plan than before we codify things. Beyond the work that I have done, both the Department of Health and Human Services and George Washington University have done some larger studies on the success of these programs, and their work's even a little more recent than mine. Some of this stuff is just coming out, and they have not found that any of these programs yet have been successful.
What do you think this legislation says about where we are as a state and as a society?
This legislation is not the only one that has been put forward in the past year to make it more difficult for people to receive cash assistance or food assistance or some sort of government aid. So I question what it says about our compassion as people and as a government to take care of those that have been hurt the most by the economy and decisions that were made beyond their control. We have the truancy bill. We have the time limits. We have the lottery. We have just just again and again and again, which individually these sound like, okay, maybe I can get behind a substance abuse treatment bill, or of course kids should be in school. And individually these are sound ideas. But when we start to step back and see that what we really have is a trend of punitive policies against people who are poor and trying to get help, then we have to ask sort of what role is our government playing? And what kind of role do we want our government to play in helping people to find success to get out of poverty?
Melissa Smith is a senior policy analyst with the Michigan League for Public Policy. She researched the effectiveness of welfare drug testing programs, and she has joined us from Lansing. Melissa, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Stateside has made a repeated request to speak with Representative Jeff Farrington, who sponsored that bill in the State House. His office has not made him available for any interviews. It has been 17 years since the Detroit Symphony Orchestra has graced the stage of one of the most famous concert halls in the world, Carnegie Hall. So it was big news for Michigan's cultural scene when the DSO became one of the symphony orchestras chosen for the 2013 Spring for Music. 1 week, 5 orchestras, 6 concerts at Carnegie Hall. And the DSO is performing 2 separate programs, one on Thursday and another on Friday. Joining us now is the music director of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, Maestro Leonard Slatkin. Welcome back to Stateside, Maestro.
Good to talk to you, Cynthia.
So tell us, what does it mean for you and for the DSO musicians to get the DSO back on the Carnegie Hall stage for that first time in 17 years?
One likes to think that every performance you do has equal meaning, whether you're playing at home, whether you're playing on the road, whether you're playing for children, whatever it happens to be. But there is still something magical and special about walking on to the stage where no less a figure than Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky conducted the very first concert. Mm. Carnegie Hall is a storied building on there on 57th Street. All the great artists have appeared there, and of course some who are not so great. I've had the chance to be on that stage, I guess, since I was 23 years old, and have appeared there many times. And the orchestra was a regular feature as well. I remember when I was a student at the Juilliard School hearing the Detroit Symphony under Sixten Ehrling
yes.
play at Carnegie Hall.
Yes.
So this return after so many years is welcome on many fronts. First of all, there is a New York public that is eager to find out what kind of shape we're in after all the turmoil and even what we're like 17 years later, for anybody who remembers back that far. There's also a large number of people coming from Detroit to celebrate our appearance there, about 700 or 800 people each night. We are put together here with actually 5 other orchestras. Originally, it was going to be 6, but the Oregon Symphony found themselves in a cash-strapped position and couldn't make their dates, so we filled in. It will be the first orchestra to play 2 performances at Spring for Music, and the programs couldn't be more varied. So we're very excited to be back on that stage, but also excited to present this music for our home audience on Tuesday night.
That's right, because you are going to have a send-off performance tonight at Orchestra Hall. We want to let everybody know that DSO will have a free preview performance of what's to come later this week at Carnegie Hall, and they'll be performing symphonies from Charles Ives and Kurt Weill's The 7 Deadly Sins. And that performance can also be streamed live on the web at dso.org starting at 7 p.m. this evening. You know, Maestro, I can only imagine your sense of pride hearing the DSO take this complex material and really digest it and put it out there for an audience. And so the idea that you're going to be doing this on the Carnegie Hall stage, that has to be a personal high for you.
Yes, and not only that, but we're very gratified already that of the 6 performances taking place, and I believe the others are Albany, Buffalo, Baltimore, and Washington, the top 2 ticket sellers so far are both the Detroit Symphony. So there.
Yeah. Maestro Leonard Slatkin will be leading the Detroit Symphony Orchestra in performances May 9th and 10th at the Spring for Music Festival at Carnegie Hall. And before those New York performances, there will be a special send-off concert tonight at Orchestra Hall. It is free of charge. Maestro Slatkin, it is always a pleasure speaking with you, and thank you for taking the time as you get ready for that big week in New York.
Yep, we look forward to seeing everybody there, and if you can't be there, you can listen to the whole concert both nights online.
Great. One more way that the DSO is kind of showing other orchestras how to get out there in the 21st century.
Yes, we are.
Thank you, sir, very much.
Take care.
When we parents send our kids off to college, we do so with fingers tightly crossed that they will remain safe and sound. Will they be safe, you wonder, as they head back to the dorm after a night class or evening study group at the library? Will they be safe going down to the laundry room in the dorm? Then you consider all the ramifications of the social side of college life, from parties to bar crawls and everything in between. Well, statistics from the Centers for Disease Control support those concerns. The CDC reports 1 in 5 women report having been raped at some time in their lives. By the way, the figure for men is 1 in 71. And other studies find college women are at greater risk for rape and other forms of sexual assault than women in the general population. So what can be done to stop this and to keep young women safe? Jess Klein joins us now in the studio. She's with the Women's Resource Center at Eastern Michigan University. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
I want to start by getting everybody on the same page mm-hmm. with regards to terminology as we talk. I feel fairly confident that when we use the term rape, that's clear to everyone. Maybe not. But the term sexual assault made me wonder, what does that exactly mean?
So sexual assault is pretty much an umbrella term for all these other things. So you have this huge spectrum of things. You have everything from sexual harassment with unwanted gestures or touching or things like that, all the way to forcible rape or
okay.
penetration.
Okay.
So it runs a gamut.
And I think that is where you get to wonder about how much of that is reported, because I see this one survey that says 37% of women who were victims of rape were raped between the ages of 18 to 24. Do you think that figure is accurate, or do you think it's too low?
I think it's absolutely too low. But it does go to show you, you know, 1 in 4 women in college will be sexually assaulted in their lifetime. 1 in 3 to 1 in 5 women all over the world will be sexually assaulted in their lifetime. But statistics show that that number is absolutely too low.
Why is it so underreported?
Lot of reasons. So specifically speaking with college campuses, you know, there's a lot of self-blame that goes into young women who are assaulted. First of all, you have to understand what sexual assault actually is. So if you go, well, you know, I was just groped, or I wasn't penetrated, or, you know, I was really drunk, so I must have put myself in that situation, you know. So it's kind of this self-blame or this confusion that goes into what actually mm-hmm. happened to you. So there's that. There's the fear that you're not going to be believed. There's the fear that you put yourself in that situation, so therefore you asked for it.
Is that victim blaming?
Absolutely.
Why do I bet that that doesn't happen if something happens to a man? Or does it?
Well, it absolutely does. Male assault is absolutely underreported as well. If a man is assaulted by another man, there is this stigma in society that he may be gay or identified
okay.
as gay, or that he should have done something to stop it,
okay.
and that he's stronger than that and should have been more masculine than
so
that.
So victim blaming seems to happen a lot when sexual assault claims come up.
Absolutely, all across the board for men and women.
Does that come from peers? Does it come from elders, like parents? Where does the victim blaming coming from?
Well, I think it comes from a lot of different places. But if you think about it, I mean, we're not learning about sexual assault in high school or middle school or even elementary school. When parents hear the word sex, they kind of forget the UAL at the end and say, oh, sexual assault. Well, this is about sex, and I'm not going to think about my kids having sex, so therefore we're not going to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the stigma alone on sex and what that looks like then translate that to sexual assault, we're not talking about it at a very young age. So it's no wonder that a lot of people do blame themselves, because they're not being educated about it.
Okay. Now I want to ask you about another term that I've seen and get your take on it. What, when we hear the phrase rape culture, what does that mean? And give us, what does that look like? And give us examples.
That's a great question. So in our society, we are actually all responsible for creating a culture where rape is perpetrated and basically sustained and where it exists in the first place. So violence is a social construction, just as gender, just as race. So when we say the words rape culture, what we're saying is this, it's kind of this, these arbitrary rules that we put on women in our society to kind of, you know, give them a box that they have to fit in. So basically, we tell women that if they go out too late at night and they're assaulted, it's their fault. If they wear these certain kinds of clothing, then, and they're assaulted, it may be their fault. So before women even leave the house, they think, is this too late? Do I have my pepper spray with me? I don't have a buddy, system tonight. Should I go out? Should I wear this low-cut top? So women are constantly asking themselves or checking their own behaviors before they go anywhere.
But isn't that smart? Shouldn't they have to? Shouldn't we be doing that anyway, just as part of living in 21st century life?
Well, you know, I don't think so. I mean, do men have to? There's really no equivalent to a low-cut top for a man. Okay. There's, you know, men are allowed to go out late at night, and we should be allowed to make any choices we want. If somebody steals my cell phone, yeah, sure, it was my fault that I left it out, but it's not someone else's to take. You know, so it's my body, it's my property, and you don't get to decide what's for it. So we need to start to switch the language to say, well, maybe you shouldn't touch me, you know, instead of why can't I wear this? Why shouldn't I look like this?
Why can't I walk home from the library?
Exactly.
I'm speaking with Jess Klein, who's with the Women's Resource Center at Eastern Michigan University, looking at the problem of sexual assault, particularly against women on college campuses. And Jess, when you talk about preventative messages, do you aim them at men, women, more one the other equally?
Both, actually. So when I do this in front of classrooms, my first question is, gentlemen in the room, what do you do on a daily basis to keep yourself from being sexually assaulted? And they all look at each other. They have nothing to say. Women, what do you do on a daily basis? You know, their hands go up. Well, I carry pepper spray. I carry a concealed weapon. I look in the backseat of my car. And, you know, it's everything. But there's a difference between secondary prevention and primary prevention. Secondary prevention are things we can do on an individual level. So risk reduction.
All right.
Prevented
the pepper spray,
yes.
The walking with a buddy.
Yes, walking in well-lit areas, looking in the backseat of our car, covering our drinks at parties, whatnot.
Okay.
But then the other hand to that is primary prevention, which basically means that we're educating people on a societal level to say that we can stop rape. We can stop this rape culture because we're ultimately the ones who created the rape culture.
And how do we do that? So when you're talking about that primary, there's the $64,000 question.
Yeah.
How?
Well, there's a lot of college campuses across the country that have specific programming. There's a lot of research out there that says, you know, these are the best groups to target, so, and this is the best way to do it. So in terms of education, there are some college campuses have an actual sexual assault coordinator that does things within the classroom. Other schools have orientation programs where they strictly learn about sexual violence, but not just, you know, this is what will happen if you rape somebody or this is what will happen if you, you know, are assaulted, but don't rape. And this is why. This is how we can create this. If you hear somebody, you know, tell a sexist joke or catcalling, maybe you should stand up for them. So it's all about the bystander effect, too. How to be an effective bystander and how to be a good friend.
Jess, I'm thinking of friends of mine whose college-bound kids are doing their high school graduation parties. They're getting ready to head off in August or September for college campuses. So what should parents be doing right now as far as messages to sons and daughters heading for college?
I think that we have to tell parents to, first of all, trust their children, you know, with the decisions that they make. It's got to start before you go to college. So do you have young folks in your life? You know, are you babysitting? Do you have nieces and nephews? Do you have children? Talk to them about respect at a very young age. You know, if you think about it, when little Susie comes home from school when she's, you know, 5 years old and said, you know, little Bobby hit me, and mom says, well, that's just because he likes you. Mm-hmm. You know, we're sending a message from a very young age that men are allowed to do that because they like us. So I think that it really starts then. And we have to send this message of respect. And we also have to talk about the influences of our peer groups and make sure that, you know, your children can think for themselves, but can also not be afraid to stand up to their friends if someone makes an inappropriate comment or a gesture or something like that.
And the peer group thing is, I think, as the mother of a boy and a girl, a much bigger problem for girls because you don't want to stand out. You don't want to go against the flow.
Absolutely.
And it's hard to know how to raise our daughters because it seems that even if you try to say, think for yourself, tune out the bully. I mean, we're really getting into a lot of other issues, but it all kind of comes down to your right to say, no, not for me.
Exactly. But for someone else to respect that.
Yeah.
So telling a gentleman that, you know, a woman is not a conquest. Sex is not a thing. It's a relationship, whatever that, if it's a 10-minute relationship or a 10-year mm-hmm. relationship. So those are the kinds of messages that we need to be sending.
And so your hope for these girls coming to campus, either as first-time freshmen or returning students, when we got the summer off for a lot of folks,
mm-hmm.
but they'll be back soon. Your hope for these kids?
Well, take a women's studies class first of all. Get involved in some sort of social justice action, whatever that may be, and don't just do something because you feel it's, you know, kind of cool, but really understand why you're doing the work that you're doing. And when you understand why a social problem exists, it's then that you can really start to stand up for those people and really start to get involved in the movement.
Jess Klein from the Women's Resource Center at Eastern Michigan University. Thank you so much for coming in and talking with us today.
Thank
on Stateside.
You.
You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, it has been nearly 2 months now since U.S. Democratic Senator Carl Levin announced he would not seek a seventh term. That announcement sets up one of the biggest political questions in Michigan. Who will take over his seat in 2014? Last week, three-time Congressman Gary Peters announced he will run for Levin's seat. Democrats say Peters gives them a strong candidate. Republicans say the congressman has supported left-leaning policies that have become unpopular in Michigan. Congressman and now Senate candidate Gary Peters joins us now. Welcome back to Stateside, Congressman.
Wonderful to be with you, Cindy.
I want to start, if we can, let's go first to the detractors who say that you are just too far left to be able to fairly represent the entire state. What's your response?
Well, I don't believe that's the case. In fact, it's certainly been proven the fact that I've represented very diverse communities, having represented Oakland County for two terms in Congress, and now, of course, in a new district that includes half of Wayne County and half of Oakland County. I believe that I've represented the diversity of this great state over these last few years and look forward to continuing to do that. And basically, my philosophy is you need to get out in communities, you need to listen to folks, and then hear what they have to say, then take it to Washington and be an aggressive advocate for the issues that matter most to Michigan middle-class families.
So what do you say to someone like Henry Payne, who wrote in the Detroit News, and here's his quote, his liberal anti-small business advocacy for Obamacare and higher taxes seed doubt about the real Gary Peters?
Well, of course, you have to consider the source. And as you know, he is basically a mouthpiece for the Michigan Republican Party. So you've got to take everything with a grain of salt. But I have been focused on small business since day one. In fact, I was the principal author of the Small Business Jobs Act, which was considered one of the most significant pieces of small business legislation to come out of Congress in the last decade or two. Focused primarily on making sure that our small businesses have access to the loans and the funding that they needed in order to grow and expand. Parts of that bill, which I authored, have already been credited with helping to create thousands of jobs here in the state of Michigan. So we're going to be able to show facts of what I've done over the last few years, a record of accomplishment, and really my focus on making sure that Main Street takes a priority over Wall Street, and unfortunately, Wall Street tends to trump things in Washington, and we've got to return that focus to our Main Street businesses and small businesses, and that's what I've done since day one, and I look forward to continuing to do it in the U.S. Senate.
Let me ask you, just kind of looking ahead, Congressman, to the weeks to come, if someone else enters as a Democrat and there turns out to be a primary, who do you think could be a possible opponent? As you're looking at the landscape?
I don't think about who could be possible opponents, who could be getting in the race. What I do is just focus on our campaign. We have instituted our listening tour around the state. I've been traveling around. Last week I was in Flint and Lansing and Grand Rapids. So we'll continue to do that, getting out, talking to folks, but more importantly, listening to people. My view is that the most important conversations that someone in elective office needs to focus on are the conversations that occur around the dinner table as families grapple with issues like like whether or not they can afford higher education for their children, whether they can afford health care, they can retire with dignity. Those are the kinds of things that I focus on. Those are the things that I worry about. And those are the types of things that I fight for in Washington, D.C.
With approval ratings nationally, this is coast to coast, with approval ratings for Congress so low and really so down in the dumps in the sense that people have of gridlock in inaction, what changes need to be made? How do you get people to actually trust their government again? And I guess I'm asking, how do you believe you could make a difference in all of that if you're in the Senate?
Well, people are certainly very frustrated by the inability for people to get together and work and to try to find common ground. You know, I come from a long business background prior to being in elective office as a businessman for many years. And the thing that is important is that we put aside ideology and instead focus on practical, common sense solutions. That has been what I have done in Washington over these last few years, trying to reach across the aisle, working in a bipartisan fashion. I'm currently working, for example, with a gentleman from California, John Campbell, who's a Republican representing the Orange County area of Southern California. We're working on significant legislation to reform the mortgage market. We've also worked together to form the auto caucus, which is very important for us in Michigan. It is a bipartisan caucus that I put together of over 62 members. In fact, there's 31 Democrats and 31 Republicans on this caucus, finding common ground to help an industry that is absolutely essential for the middle class and essential for us, certainly in Michigan. So I'm a big believer that the only way that folks will be pleased with what's happening in Washington is when they see things getting done. And the only way we can get things done is by reaching across the aisle and working together on common sense solutions. And that's what I've been doing these last few years and will continue to do.
And I guess finally, just for the constituents of your 14th district, how will campaigning for the Senate impact taking care of business in the House?
Well, my focus is continuing to do the job that I was elected to do in the 14th district, and I'll be here in Washington fighting for issues that people care very deeply about in my community. That won't focus, although when I'm home, I will continue to travel around Michigan hearing some of the concerns from people around the state. But to me, there's a lot that we have in common, whether it's in the 14th district or other places around the state of Michigan. We're all looking for the same things to make sure folks have a quality, good-paying job, have the ability to, as I say, retire with dignity and have health care. Those are the issues that impact middle-class families, whether they're in southeast Michigan or the west side of the state or the northern part of the state. And those are things that I fight for every day in Washington.
Congressman and Senate candidate Gary Peters, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime.
Let us move now from the Democratic Senate candidate to the view from the GOP side of things. Just who might be the Republicans' best hope of winning Carl Levin's Senate seat? Joining us is Republican strategist Dennis Lennox. Welcome back to Stateside, Dennis.
Hey, good afternoon.
So what challenge do you think the candidacy of Gary Peters presents to Michigan's Republicans?
Well, quite simply, it's pretty difficult to be against somebody when you don't have a candidate.
And why hasn't a Republican just seized this and jumped in? What's keeping this from happening?
Well, your guess is probably as good as mine. If you would have asked me 3 months ago when Carl Levin announced that he wasn't running for election next year, I would have rattled off names like Rick Snyder, the governor, you know, our Attorney General Bill Schuette, or even Candace Miller, the congresswoman from Macomb County, home of the Reagan Democrats, as potential Republican replacements. But unfortunately, at least for somebody on my side of the aisle, one by one, they've taken their names out of consideration. And now it's basically down to Mike Rogers and Justin Amash.
So what's going on here? Why do you think people are stepping up to say, no, don't think of me?
Well, you know, there's probably a lot of internal considerations. Obviously, when you're governor, you're probably thinking you would rather be governor, particularly when the Democrats can't find somebody to run against you. You know, that may be the understated story of the year, that the Democrats can't find a single person willing to run for governor. But also, it's just a realization that running statewide in a state that has went Democratic at the presidential level, at least, since 1992, can be very challenging. And Republicans do face a tone and messaging challenge that I don't know if everybody in the party has figured out how to, you know, address going forward.
So there is certainly, we all know it is certainly a state of flux for the GOP in Michigan and nationally. But then there has to be somebody on your side of the aisle who's looking at that seat saying, I don't know, maybe I could be the person. So who should we keep an eye on?
Well, actually, I'd be looking at Craigslist to see if somebody takes an ad out saying candidate wanted. But in all seriousness, I think Mike Rogers and Justin Amash, both members of Congress, are probably sure things at the moment. They're definitely giving it serious consideration. But they have their own practical consideration. I don't actually think Rogers is going to run when push comes to shove. I think he would probably rather stay as chairman of the Intelligence Committee. It's a very plumb position. And then for Justin Amash, you know, he's a young 30-something disciple of Ron Paul. He could keep his House seat for 10 years, or he could give it up and run for Senate, which wouldn't be a sure thing, or he could keep his House seat for a couple more years and run for governor in 2018, which I think actually when you look at Justin Amash, he also may not run because he's probably doing the political calculus and saying in 2018, presuming Rick Snyder is reelected, there isn't a clear name right now for governor or some of the other offices like attorney general that he could run for.
What about Terry Lynn Land?
I like Terry Lynn Land. I think having a woman as a candidate is something the Republican Party desperately needs at the moment. It's a key demographic. In fact, the majority of voters are women. However, I think she's better in the position that she has right now and as an internal party leader, and some have talked about her perhaps being a candidate for national Republican Party chairman, would be the first woman ever to have that position. I just don't think the time is right for her for U.S. Senate.
Okay, you're just feeling that. It makes me wonder, speaking of timing, how loudly is the clock ticking for Republicans? Now you got Gary Peters in there for, you know, stepped right up for the Democrats. How does a later GOP entry affect the race in terms of message and campaigning and fundraising?
I think the clock is ticking pretty loudly. In fact, I think it's time to put an ad on Craigslist saying candidate wanted. Bobby Shostak, the chairman of the Michigan Republican Party, in my opinion, needs to exercise some of his prerogatives as chairman and draft a candidate and perhaps amend the rules to do away with the three-ring circus atmosphere that often overshadows primary contests. I mean, that's also a big reason why some people don't want to run, for the simple fact that they have to spend a year and a half just to win the primary before they ever get to face off against Gary Peters. You know, Gary Peters is a threat to the Republicans in Michigan for the simple fact that you can't be against a candidate when you don't have an alternative.
And then let's just talk history, which I suspect many of these names that have said, no thanks. You look at both Senate seats, and Carl Levin's had a lock on his since he beat Republican Robert Griffin. That was 1978. And then you look at Senator Stabenow's seat, and you had Spencer Abraham, that single term from 95 to 2001, and that was the only win for the GOP since Charles Potter, and that was back in the 1950s. So, you know, in your heart of hearts, do you think a GOP candidate really has any chance of replacing Carl Levin?
Oh, absolutely. Let's face it, too, that many of those elections occurred in presidential years or they were incumbents. The reality is when there's an actual open senatorial seat in a non-presidential year, it generally favors Republicans in Michigan. It's just something that historically hasn't happened a lot. I think Republicans with a Candace Miller, a Rick Snyder, or a Bill Schuette would have an outstanding chance. While they've kind of said no, I'm not convinced that if enough grandees of the party came to them and said, here's a check, we're funding your campaign, you're running, that they would say no. I think Candace Miller would be a stellar candidate. She's from the right part of the state. You know, Republicans don't win when they run somebody from West Michigan. So it's maybe not fair. It is a big state. You know, I'm from somebody that lives north of Clare. We often get on the short side of things. But the reality of the matter is southeastern Michigan drives the state. You know, no pun intended.
Sure.
And if we want to win as a party, we better find somebody that lives in the big three counties around Detroit. Or we're going to face a real challenge, because Gary Peters is as good as they get when it comes to career politicians. You know, he's great at talking that centrist Democratic talking points and voting extreme liberal, you know, when it gets time. And I think if Republicans don't wake up and find a real strong candidate and they don't learn their lessons from 2012 when we had a shot of defeating Senator Stabenow, we're going to have a Senator Gary Peters for a long time to come.
And what I'll let you grandstand a little bit here for the GOP, Dennis Lennox, since as a younger member of the party, what would the party offer the people of Michigan that a Gary Peters would not?
Well, I think you have to look to Lansing. You have to look to what Republicans have done in Lansing and say, we've done it in Lansing, we can replicate it in Washington. The fact of the matter is, the solutions to the great challenges facing Michigan aren't going to come out of the Beltway in Washington. They're going to come from the 50 state capitals and the small towns in flyover country. And that's what you see Republicans succeeding every day. And that's why you're looking at the landscape in 2014, just not in Michigan, but in many of the other states with Senate races, they really do favor Republicans because these are the states that are electing Republican governors. Let's not forget, Rick Snyder's on the ballot in 2014, and the Democrats can't even find a single candidate to run against a Republican governor, despite President Obama overwhelmingly winning Michigan.
I don't want to go off too deep in the weeds here, but I would like your thoughts. Do you not have a party, when you talk about the Michigan Republicans, when you have someone like Brooks Patterson saying that House Speaker Jace Bulger reminds him of, invoking Adolf Hitler when he's talking about Jace Bulger, does that not say that there's a party with some internal dissension that needs to be healed?
Well, the Democrats are the party that had a KKK grand wizard as their majority leader.
Well, I want to talk about why the Brooks Patterson comment about Jace Bulger. Let's just talk about
the Democrats are the party of Jim Crow and segregation forever. The Republicans have always been the party of civil rights. The Democrats have their kooks and Republicans have their kooks, but at the end of the day, the race is decided by candidates that it can appeal to the center and not to the extremes of either party.
So what will you be looking for going forward, besides that possible Craigslist ad that you've been joking about? But what are you looking for, Dennis, as we look ahead?
Well, it's not me. I think the legion of Republican foot soldiers across the state want a candidate, and they want a candidate now. We can't wait till September. And that's what Amash and Rogers and some of the others have talked about, that they're going to wait till the Republicans have their conference on Mackinac Island in September. I think if you're serious, if you're somebody out there truly looking at running for U.S. Senate, you've got to announce before the 4th of July, because we all know what Michiganders do in the summertime. They take off for their cottage. And frankly, in a state with 83 counties, unless the rules change with respect to the primaries, you've got to get out there now to hit all those rubber chicken dinners between now and next August.
Republican strategist Dennis Lennox, he actually recently wrote a column about this very issue. GOP candidate for Senate wanted, wrote it for the Morning Sun paper. And Dennis was kind enough to join us from Traverse City. Good talking with you, Dennis. Thanks so much.
Thanks as always.
And speaking of U.S. Representative Mike Rogers, a group representing FBI agents and retirees says it wants President Obama to make the congressman the next director of the FBI. The Brighton Republican worked as an FBI agent before first being elected to the state Senate and then later to Congress. Just yesterday, the FBI Agents Association endorsed Rogers to replace FBI Director Robert Mueller. His 10-year term was extended by Congress for 2 years. It ends in September, and the search is on for his replacement. Well, the organization of agents says Rogers is respected on both sides of the aisle, and his background as a special agent sets him apart. The 49-year-old Rogers chairs the House Intelligence Committee. In a statement, he says he is honored and humbled by the endorsement. Let us move now from the Democratic Senate candidate to the view from the GOP side of things. Just who might be the Republicans' best hope of winning Carl Levin's Senate seat? Joining us is Republican strategist Dennis Lennox. Welcome back to Stateside, Dennis.
Good afternoon.
So what challenge do you think the candidacy of Gary Peters presents to Michigan's Republicans?
Well, quite simply, it's pretty difficult to be against somebody when you don't have a candidate.
And why hasn't a Republican just seized this and jumped in? What's keeping this from happening?
Well, your guess is probably as good as mine. If you would have asked me 3 months ago when Carl Levin announced that he wasn't running for election next year, I would have rattled off names like Rick Snyder, the governor, our Attorney General Bill Schuette, or even Candace Miller, the congresswoman from Macomb County, home of the Reagan Democrats, as potential Republican replacements. But unfortunately, at least for somebody on my side of the aisle, one by one, they've taken their names out of consideration, and now it's basically down to Mike Rogers and Justin Amash.
So what's going on here? Why do you think people are stepping up to say, no, don't think of me?
Well, You know, there's probably a lot of internal considerations. Obviously, when you're governor, you're probably thinking you would rather be governor, particularly when the Democrats can't find somebody to run against you. You know, that may be the understated story of the year, that the Democrats can't find a single person willing to run for governor. But also, it's just a realization that running statewide in a state that has went Democratic at the presidential level, at least, since 1992, can be very challenging. And Republicans do face a tone and messaging challenge that I don't know if everybody in the party has figured out how to, you know, address going forward.
So there is certainly, we all know it is certainly a state of flux for the GOP in Michigan and nationally. But then there has to be somebody on your side of the aisle who's looking at that seat saying, I don't know, maybe I could be the person. So who should we keep an eye on?
I'd be looking at Craigslist to see if somebody takes an ad out saying candidate wanted. But in all seriousness, I think Mike Rogers and Justin Amash, both members of Congress, are probably sure things at the moment. They're definitely giving it serious consideration. But they have their own practical consideration. I don't actually think Rogers is going to run when push comes to shove. I think he would probably rather stay as chairman of the Intelligence Committee. It's a very plum position. And then for Justin Amash, you know, he's a young 30-something disciple of Ron Paul. He could keep his House seat for 10 years, or he could give it up and run for Senate, which wouldn't be a sure thing, or he could keep his House seat for a couple more years and run for governor in 2018, which I think actually when you look at Justin Amash, he also may not run because he's probably doing the political calculus and saying, in 2018, presuming Rick Snyder is reelected, there isn't a clear name right now for governor or some of the other offices like attorney general that he could run for.
What about Terry Lynn Land?
I like Terry Lynn Land. I think having a woman as a candidate is something the Republican Party desperately needs at the moment. It's a key demographic. In fact, the majority of voters are women. I think she's better in the position that she has right now and as an internal party leader, and some have talked about her perhaps being a candidate for national Republican Party chairman, would be the first woman ever to have that position. I just don't think the time is right for her for U.S. Senate.
Okay, you're just feeling that. It makes me wonder, speaking of timing, how loudly is the clock ticking for Republicans? Now you got Gary Peters in there for, you know, stepped right up for the Democrats. How does a later GOP entry affect the race in terms of message and campaigning and fundraising?
I think the clock is ticking pretty loudly. In fact, I think it's time to put an ad on Craigslist saying candidate wanted. Bobby Shostak, the chairman of the Michigan Republican Party, in my opinion, needs to exercise some of his prerogatives as chairman and draft a candidate and perhaps amend the rules to do away with the three-ring circus atmosphere that often overshadows primary contests. I mean, that's also a big reason why some people don't want to run, for the simple fact that they have to spend a year and a half just to win the primary before they ever get to face off against Gary Peters. You know, Gary Peters is a threat to the Republicans in Michigan for the simple fact that you can't be against a candidate when you don't have an alternative.
And then let's just talk history, which I suspect many of these names that have said, no thanks. You look at both Senate seats, and Carl Levin's had a lock on his since he beat Republican Robert Griffin. That was 1978. And then you look at Senator Stabenow's seat, and you had Spencer Abraham, that single term from 95 to 2001. And that was the only win for the GOP since Charles Potter, and that was back in the 1950s. So, you know, in your heart of hearts, do you think a GOP candidate really has any chance of replacing Carl Levin?
Oh, absolutely. Let's face it, too, that many of those elections occurred in presidential years or they were incumbents. The reality is when there's an actual open senatorial seat in a non-presidential year, it generally favors Republicans in Michigan. It's just something that historically hasn't happened a lot. I think Republicans with a Candace Miller, a Rick Snyder or Bill Schuette would have an outstanding chance. Well, they've kind of said no. I'm not convinced that if enough grandees of the party came to them and said, here's a check, we're funding your campaign, you're running, that they would say no. I think Candace Miller would be a stellar candidate. She's from the right part of the state. You know, Republicans don't win when they run somebody from West Michigan. So it, it's maybe not fair. It is a big state. You know, I'm from somebody that lives north of Clare. We often get on the short side of things, but the reality of the matter is southeastern Michigan drives the state. You know, no pun intended.
Sure.
And if we want to win as a party, we better find somebody that lives in the big three counties around Detroit, or we're going to face a real challenge, because Gary Peters is as good as they get when it comes to career politicians. You know, he's great at talking that centrist Democratic talking points and voting extreme liberal, you know, when it gets time. And I think if Republicans don't wake up and find a real strong candidate, and they don't learn their lessons from 2012 when we had a shot of defeating Senator Stabenow, we're going to have a Senator Gary Peters for a long time to come.
And what I'll let you grandstand a little bit here for the GOP, Dennis Lennox, since as a younger member of the party, what would the party offer the people of Michigan that a Gary Peters would not?
Well, I think you have to look to Lansing. You have to look to what Republicans have done in Lansing and say, we've done it in Lansing, we can replicate it in Washington. The fact of the matter is, the solutions to the great challenges facing Michigan aren't going to come out of the Beltway in Washington. They're going to come from the 50 state capitals and the small towns that can fly over country. And that's what you see Republicans succeeding every day. And that's why you're looking at the landscape in 2014, just not in Michigan, but in many of the other states with Senate races, they really do favor Republicans, because these are the states that are electing Republican governors. Let's not forget, Rick Snyder's on the ballot in 2014, and the Democrats can't even find a single candidate to run against a Republican governor, despite President Obama overwhelmingly winning Michigan.
I don't want to go off too deep in the weeds here, but I would like your thoughts. Do you not have a party, when you talk about the Michigan Republicans, when you have someone like Brooks Patterson saying that House Speaker Jace Bolger reminds him of, you know, invoking Adolf Hitler when he's talking about Jace Bolger, does that not say that there's a party with some internal dissension that needs to be healed?
Well, the Democrats are the party that had a KKK grand wizard as their majority leader.
Well, I want to talk about why the Brooks Patterson comment about Jace Bolger. Let's just talk about
it. The Democrats are the party of Jim Crow and segregation forever. The Republicans have always been the party of civil rights. The Democrats have their kooks and Republicans have their kooks. But at the end of the day, the race is decided by candidates that it can appeal to the center and not to the extremes of either party.
So what will you be looking for going forward, besides that possible Craigslist ad that you've been joking about? But what are you looking for, Dennis, as we look ahead?
Well, it's not me. I think the legion of Republican foot soldiers across the state want a candidate, and they want a candidate now. We can't wait till September, and that's what Amash and Rogers and some of the others have talked about, that they're going to wait till the Republicans have their conference on Mackinac Island in September. I think if you're serious, if you're somebody out there truly looking at running for U.S. Senate, you've got to announce before the 4th of July, because we all know what Michiganders do in the summertime. They take off for their cottage. And frankly, in a state with 83 counties, unless the rules change with respect to the primaries, you've got to get out there now to hit all those rubber chicken dinners between now and next August.
Republican strategist Dennis Lennox, he actually recently wrote a column about this very issue. GOP candidate for Senate wanted, wrote it for the Morning Sun paper. And Dennis was kind enough to join us from Traverse City. Good talking with you, Dennis. Thanks so much.
Thanks, as always.
And speaking of U.S. Representative Mike Rogers, a group representing FBI agents and retirees says it wants President Obama to make the congressman the next director of the FBI. The Brighton Republican worked as an FBI agent before first being elected to the state Senate and then later to Congress. Just yesterday, the FBI Agents Association endorsed Rogers to replace FBI Director Robert Mueller. His 10-year term was extended by Congress for 2 years. It ends in September, and the search is on for his replacement. Well, the organization of agents says Rogers is respected on both sides of the aisle, and his background as a special agent sets him apart. 49-year-old Rogers chairs the House Intelligence Committee. In a statement, he says he is honored and humbled by the endorsement.
We'd like to connect with you. Of course, we say this, and we love hearing from you. You can find us online. Just go to michiganradio.org and search for the Stateside link. Go to Facebook, search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scahn. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Austin Davis, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3.